This episode is sponsored by Bubs Naturals, yet another company that I tracked down to bring on as a sponsor because I myself love their products. They are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a 20% discount. But before we get to that, I do want to highlight a few of the products that I use myself. Firstly, collagen. I am about to turn 50, and so my hair, my skin, my nails, not really a big concern when I was younger, definitely a lot more of a concern now. However, where I've really seen the impact is joint health and gut health, and I've been blown away that when I'm consistent using collagen, Bubs collagen in this case, I see a massive improvement in both. Another area, I drink coffee, love coffee, and in the morning, I use the Halo Creamer. Now, originally, I used the MCT oil powder, but now they have the Halo Creamer, which has also got grass-fed butter in it, a lot more creamy if you're not trying to go for the vegan option that they have as well. Now, it's important to mention as well the altruistic element of Bubs Naturals. The origin story involves Glenn Bub Doherty, one of the two Navy SEALs killed in Benghazi, and a good friend of the founders, Sean and TJ. So 10% of every single sale goes towards the Glenn Doherty Foundation. Now, as I mentioned before, they are offering you, the audience, 20% off your purchase if you use the code SHIELD. That's S-H-I-E-L-D at bubsnaturals.com. And finally, if you want to hear more about their products and Glenn's powerful story, listen to episode 558 with co-founder Sean Lake. This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5.11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5.11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's S-H-I-E-L-D-1-5, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5.11, who they stand for and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5.11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Royal Marine veteran, author, and cancer survivor, Rian Eilert. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics from Rian's early life, the Scared Straight program he went to in Mexico as a young man, his journey into the Royal Marines, some of his deployments overseas, the day he got his brain tumor diagnosis, his recovery journey, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Rian Eilert. Enjoy.
We'll be right back.
Well, Rian, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you, your evening, my afternoon?
So I'm in Portsmouth.
Brilliant. So I would love to start at the very beginning then. Tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
So I was born in a hospital called St. Peter's in Chertsey near Heathrow Airport, and I grew up in Guildford. I've got a younger sister who's a police officer, and I had a very good upbringing with my mum and dad.
Brilliant.
I was also very close to my grandparents.
Your grandparents? Well, tell me about them. What were their backgrounds?
So, obviously, they were both children in World War II, grew up in what I'd argue is the last of the best generations that had it hard but made the best of bad situations. All of my family are from London.
What do they talk about? Because my parents were kids in World War II as well. They were, you know, evacuated when they were bombing all the cities, but they were very, very small, like toddlers, basically. What did your grandparents talk about when they reminisce on the rebuilding after World War II? Because it seems to be very different, the American experience versus the British experience, because obviously no one really came to the mainland of the US and bombed them. But, you know, the UK was decimated, you know, financially and, you know, infrastructure as well. So here there was a lot of affluence, and we call them the boomers, you know, the generation after the World War II generation. And, you know, there's some incredible human beings, but there is almost the pendulum swung so far the other way, I think, from the horrors that the World War II, you know, generation saw and the umbrella they put around their children. So, you know, that you could argue there's almost a sense of entitlement because they didn't feel that suffering they gained from, you know, the rebuilding of the US and the affluence and that kind of thing. And that's not a criticism, it's just an observation, because that generation didn't fight in those wars, and a lot of them didn't fight at all. Some of them were in Korea, but they were fortunate enough not to see war and to grow up around, you know, the affluence of rebuilding. So what about in the UK lens, though? What did your grandparents witness and experience when they were growing up post-war in the UK?
So similar to you, obviously they was evacuated, but they said that obviously at the time it just brought the UK together because everyone was in the same boat and everyone pulled together to rebuild this great nation.
And then what about financially? When they went back, were they experiencing any sort of poverty or anything? Because I mean, so many houses were destroyed and, you know, jobs and all those kind of things. You know, there was a lot of struggles even in the Falklands War era. They were still struggling financially in our country.
Yeah, so obviously they touched on how hard such things as what we take for granted, food, was to come by. Obviously money back then was pretty much non-existent, but they made it work in harsh times. And that's why I always refer to them as being the last of the best generation that saw the horrors of World War II and all come together, and we're still this great nation today.
Mm-hmm. It's a shame, though. I feel that as we lose the proximity to a horror like that, and we shouldn't have to have proximity to something horrendous like World War II or 9/11 or some of these other horrendous incidents, but the further we get, the quicker people forget, you know, and we lose that community. And if you turn on the TV now, there's a lot of division, you know, from, I would argue, really from kind of like COVID times onwards, you know. So they always say, oh, it takes a war to bring people together, and I wish it wouldn't. I wish it could take a leader to bring people together rather than a tragedy.
Yeah, I fully agree. I'm just British through and through and can't admit that we're still not the greatest nation on the planet.
Well, they have the same thing here. You see the flag behind me. I mean, obviously, I'm a proud Brit, you know, living in the US now, and a proud American too. I mean, you can be both. But if you just walk around saying you're the greatest and don't put the work in, then you look around one day and you're not, you know. But if you have humility and are proud of your country, but also ask other countries how they do things really well, then you all rise up and everyone grows from it.
Yeah.
So what about careers? What were your parents doing when you were young?
So my mum was a hairdresser, And my dad worked for a window fitting firm.
Did you have any military in the family at all?
No, I didn't.
Okay. And then just side tangent, what was it that sent your sister into law enforcement?
I think, and I'd like to hope, a little bit of me, because she was talking about joining the military, but I kind of said, because she was that bit younger than me, you're probably not going to get the experiences I had, because the regiment and the units I was a part of, funding's lacking in the military and that now, so you're probably not going to get the good trips. So I was like, if you're going to do anything, join the police and then work your way up to get into the counterterrorism special firearms officers.
No, because I saw in one of the things I read about you that you work with that group. Was that through her then?
No. I was doing that in my last job before I got medically discharged from the military.
Okay. And then what about her perspective? Female member of law enforcement in the UK. I'm seeing, you know, obviously a lot happening here. It seems to dribble over into the UK as well. We just had a big issue with our armed officers in the UK being kind of demonized for doing their job. And I've had several of those officers on the show. I'm getting two of them on together to talk about that. What is her perspective of policing in the UK at the moment? And then what does she think that we can do to kind of, again, we're talking about pendulums, to bring it back to the middle again?
Yeah. So I think from what I hear is that obviously there's a lot of paperwork that goes to policing now and a lot of red tape and a lot of scrutiny, which makes it hard to do just general good policing. And I think she's quite lucky because she's part of Surrey Police, not the Met. Obviously, certain areas of London are a lot more violent and riddled with crime than other areas that are on the outskirts of London.
Yeah. Yeah, I had some guys from a group of guys and girls from a group called Surfwell, and they take police officers out surfing as kind of like a mental health therapy. And I was asking them, and they're definitely more rural police officers because they didn't have the stories that some of my London police officers did.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then let's get back to you. As you were in school age, what were you playing as far as sports and athletics?
I liked football. I was always about football. That was it. I was an half-decent runner, but I put all my effort into playing football.
Did you compete at running as well?
I did a couple of cross-country runs at school, but I didn't compete in anything major.
The reason I ask, it's always interesting when people that go into military, police, fire, in their younger life had played individual sports and they played team sports. So when you look back now, what was it about, even if it was only for a short time, the cross country and then contrasting the team sport of football, if any of those applied to your success in the Royal Marines later?
Well, I was always a team player, so that was never in question. And I think the cross country running, I generally enjoyed running, which I think definitely gave me an advantage at certain times in my career with how much running you do. As you know yourself, in the British military, it's very heavy on running or running long distances with carrying weight.
Now, what about when you were at school, career aspirations? Were you dreaming of the military or was there something else in your mind at that point?
No, I wanted to be a chef. Growing up, I wanted to be a chef. Didn't end up being a chef.
What inspired you to be a chef? Were there people or were there home-cooked meals or restaurants that really kind of inspired you initially?
I don't even know, to be honest. I did a bit of that food technology at school and I half enjoyed that. And then I used to like some of them cooking programs, you know, like with like the proper professional chefs. And I was like, I fancy a bit of that. Never happened. And at 35, I probably still can't cook.
I did home economics in my GCSEs because I was terrible at woodwork, CDT. So home economics was the other one, but all the girls were in that. So it was me, my mate, Steve, and then all the girls. So, and I actually got one of my best grades in that too. So it's a good option if you're shit at woodwork. I'll tell you that now. All right. Well then what, you know, when you graduated then, were you still thinking about like pursuing culinary in community college, or did something happen that shifted you into the military?
So I started misbehaving as a teenager. And I'm not sure whether you've seen it. I'm sure a lot of people in America would have. There's been a documentary come out recently called The Program on Netflix.
I haven't seen that one, actually, no.
So it's only been out about a week and a half, and it's about behavior modification facilities out in the US, and there was a couple elsewhere that have been closed down. But I actually went to one of them for a year in Mexico because I wasn't doing well at school. I was getting into trouble. So I got a year there to think about my actions. Well, it was actually 18 months, but the facility I was in, there was a big riot and it got raided and it was closed down within 24 hours. So I was transported back to the San Diego border and then I was brought home, had to play catch up with GCSEs, and I went to Brooklands College to do a public service course. And it was there where I met my college lecturer, who was a former Royal Marine commander. And that's where we started looking at them avenues of joining the military.
Going back to the, you know, I think they call them scared straight programs is the term they use over here. You know, they'll take kids into prisons and the prisoners will all mess with them and, you know, scare the shit out of them, basically. Now, you hear of some programs that are well organized and they see, you know, they, like the fire program, for example. There's a fire program for young offenders that trains them to become wildland firefighters. And I've had people on the show that have done that. You know, talk to me about, firstly, how did you find yourself in Mexico? Because there must have been some sort of programs in the UK. And then secondly, what was that actual experience like for a young Englishman or English boy all the way down in Mexico?
So I'd been in quite a lot of trouble with the police. And obviously my parents didn't really know what to do to help me or get me off of this track of causing devastation. And I was the second British lad to go to one of these facilities. There was another lab from Birmingham. And I believe my mum may have heard of it through his experience because he was out there when I got there. And my mum spoke with the police and said, look, this is what we're looking at and we think it might help. So I was sent out there as a trial and I spent a year there. But yeah, it was horrific. It wasn't a nice place to be. You wasn't allowed to talk. You was allowed out for an hour a day. It was basically like being in prison, but with a lot less human rights. Like you see programs now where people playing pool and chilling with their friends on the landings and that. I would have taken that over what that Mexican place was like because there was no human rights going on in that facility. And also, also being the only white English kid there, obviously, you got to get a little bit more abuse than everyone else.
I'd heard on the podcast that you sent me that you were on, you talked about the program was shut down by the FBI and the Federales. So that's probably a sign that it wasn't doing what it was supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. That was the first time I'd ever had a gun pointed at me, was when the Federales and the FBI stormed it. And well, I'd imagine everyone else as well, because I was one of the youngest there. And the age range was between 14 and 18. And yeah, I remember when it got stormed, it was chaos, chaotic. Everyone just running riot everywhere. And then just loads of big Mexicans coming in with assault rifles and FBI agents. And it was like, what is going on here? It was like something out of a film. But being a teenager, I probably didn't really take it in that much then. Because all I was thinking about was trying to get some decent food, not getting mistreated and, well, basically not being in this facility anymore.
When you look back, what were the elements of that experience, even though overall it was horrific, as you said, what were any elements that you gleaned that were positive? And then, you know, talk to me about that dark side. You know, when parents send their kids trusting that the facility is going to be molding them into strong, kind young men, you know, what was the reality of your experience?
I think If I'm being honest, positives to come out of it, probably I got knocked down so many pegs, I wasn't as big and as hard as I thought I was. But it also took me, being there on your own, I had no friends there, certainly not for the first 7 months. And it kind of helped me probably stand on my own two feet and watch my own back, because there was things going on in that place every day. I mean, would I change it? No. Yeah, it was horrific. And I'm part of a Facebook group called the WASP Survivors, because that was the brand of these facilities, the Worldwide Association of Specialist Schools, I think it was. And there's a lot of people with complex PTSD that can't obviously get over what went on in these facilities. However, I'm quite thankful I went there, because I definitely think it probably gave me a good kick up the arse and some decent mental resilience to then go forward and do as well as I did in the Royal Marines.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you've got, you know, physical resilience, you've got, you know, the mental toughness, especially when you're in a group of people where some of them are going to quit. You find yourself in this school, you have this teacher who is a former Royal Marine. Walk me through that, from that conversation through to when you're actually enlisting.
So, because to join the Marines at the time, I'd imagine it's probably still the same. You needed 5 GCSEs at C and above. And I had a couple, but this college course, if I passed it, would give me what I needed to be able to join the military and the Royal Marines. So I started this college course, started rebelling a little bit because I just didn't like being in a classroom. I was never one for classrooms. And my college lecturer, he basically had just come out of the Marines, started telling me some stories and was like, ah, this might be an option for you. Get away, see the world, be a part of something. So I started looking into it. And I had, the college course was a year long. So he started to train with me and help like prepare me as best as he could for, I had a potential Royal Marines course planned for at the end of it. So I basically started going through the application process whilst on this college course. And I remember going home and telling my mum and dad that I'm going to join the Royal Marine Commandos, and they laughed at me. And then I was like, oh, I'm 100% going to be a Royal Marine Commando.
Beautiful. I mean, it's amazing how many people, the naysayers, was just fuel to their fire. And I mean, I can relate to that 100%.
You won't do that. I am now going to
hold my beer. All right. Well, then what did that look through? Yeah, because I know obviously for people that don't know the British military as well, you know, you've obviously got SAS, SBS, but then the lesser recognized element of special forces is the Royal Marines as well. And obviously there are some other groups to add to that, but it's not just entering another branch of the military. You guys are entering a much higher tier. So walk me through what training looked like, you know, overall for those next few months.
So you start with, obviously you do all your interview process and that at the careers office, you have a medical, you have a pre-joining fitness test. And then if you're successful with them, you go on to a potential Royal Marines course, which is five days down at the Commando Training Center at Limpston, which is just 5 days of showing them what you've got to offer. And obviously there's a lot of pass or fail criteria, physical assessments and some written tests. And then on the last day, you're told if you've been successful or not. And if you have been, you then get a date to start training, or they might say 6 months, start training in 6 months, or start next year. But I think at the time that the Royal Marines was quite undermanned. Obviously war had broken out, the Great War on Terror, as everyone calls it. And I started training 2 months after my PRMC. And yeah, that was a shocker capture, because it's 32 weeks long and it builds you up. But obviously a lot of it is harsh, physical and mentally, lack of food, lack of sleep, but it's relentless, it's constant, it's every day. So you do get tired and worn down, and it's just about digging deep into them reserves to get you through. And then halfway through training, after you've passed the set criteria tests at each benchmark, you then start the interesting stuff like the soldiering and the commando stuff, the amphibious stuff, the cliff assaults, and it generally becomes more interesting. I thoroughly enjoyed that side of things.
When you look back now, physically and mentally, what was it that allowed you to complete the course when some of the people applying with you failed?
I wasn't going home. I was getting that green beret, and that was the end of the story. I got back troop twice, so I didn't pass out of my original troop. I was a good runner, but I couldn't climb ropes. I mean, me at 18 years old, I was built like a butcher's toothpick. So
you and me both.
I was never, ever getting my scrawny carcass up them ropes. But we got there in the end. And then once I passed that phase, moved on to the next one, I had to climb them ropes with kit and a rifle. And I was like, ah, hold up a minute. I couldn't do it with nothing on. Now you want me to do it with kit. So that was another stumbling block. And then we got there in the end. And then, yeah, I finally passed out. I spent an extra 2 months in training. So it took me 10 months instead of 8.
I can totally relate. I think I was 20 or 21, I could only do one pull-up. And I was an athlete. I just never pulled, you know what I mean? I'd never climbed before. And then fast forward getting into CrossFit, you know, but years later, I could do rope climbs with my legs in an L, you know, like no leg rope climbs. And it's amazing to watch because, as you said, you will get there. But, you know, you can't climb a rope with no strength. I mean, you have to build that strength up and you have to understand, obviously, how to use your feet and everything else. But it is a high level strength exercise. But the beautiful thing is when you see your scrawny ass, you know, for me, it was years later, look back and go, wow, when I was 21, when I was supposed to be at my peak, I couldn't do half the shit I could do when I was, you know, 40. So it's it's kind of cool to see, you know, progression. Because I talk about this on the show quite a bit. You know, if you go to the leisure center and you know use the bodybuilding machines, there's not real pride into just putting the pin down one more weight. But when you nail something like a rope climb, that's a pretty amazing achievement.
Yeah, it's something you don't do every day, like the ropes. I used to look up at them and think, really?
Yeah, but it's functional. This is the thing. I mean, you know, hanging from things, you know, I mean, a lot of us now, I say a lot of us, myself, you know, I can barely hang up from a bar for more than a minute or so. But then you think about, you know, the people that carry pots of water for miles in some of these poorer countries. I mean, their endurance and strength, you know, just is makes us laughable. So, you know, I think it's good when you can go back to what we would have done, you know, a long time ago, which was climbing and, you know, crawling and some of these other things that we just don't do.
Yeah.
So again, going back to the podcast, when you graduated and you got your beret, there's usually a bit of a gap. Am I right? And before you actually deploy, but yours was quite short. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. So you get to it's called King Squad Week. So you've passed your commando tests, you've got your green beret, and then you have a week where you're doing like leaving administration for leaving Limpston to join a commando unit, and you get a choice. It's not guaranteed you'll get your choice, but you can choose what units you'd like to go to. And you do a lot of marching and ceremonial stuff ready for the pass out parade for when all your family come down and watch you get presented with your coveted green beret, which was a fantastic day. And anyone who's ever witnessed a pass out will say what an amazing day it is, obviously off the back of an amazing achievement. But 40 Commando were just going to Afghanistan as I was leaving training. So we was told not to put 40 Commando as our first choice because they were fully manned and they were going out the door. But I put 40 Commando anyway because I always wanted to go to 40 Commando. And miraculously, me and I think four other lads from my troop got 40 Commando. So we had a long weekend and then we joined 40 Commando on the Tuesday, and then that was it. We were straight into pre-deployment training, and then we deployed 5.5 weeks later and met the unit out in Afghanistan.
Before we go to your first Afghanistan deployment, you are in the pass-out parade, you're getting your green beret, your parents are there, the ones that told you could never be a Royal Marine. Talk to me about that conversation.
It is what it is, isn't it? You can see it. It's happening. You're watching me get it. So there you go. One of them two things.
Was there an element of pride, though? I mean, you know, go back 2 years, you're in a scared straight facility in Mexico that gets shut down by the FBI and the federales, and now fast forward 2 years, you're wearing a green beret. So, you know, what do you remember, any conversations about the kind of metamorphosis that you'd made as a young man?
Not really, but they were just obviously really relieved and proud that I'd achieved something that at the time the slogan was 99.99% need not apply, and I'd had the mental robustness and the physical attributes to finally get that coveted green beret and get to where I wanted to be. I'm sure they obviously had sleepless nights throughout my career wondering if they'd got a knock on the door from the padre and the welfare officer, but it was obviously a lot better than the road I was going down, where I might have got killed and end up in prison anyway.
When you talk about 99.9% need not apply, I think it was Mark Omrid and maybe Ben Wadham as well. Like several of the Royal Marines that I've had on the show, that was what got them. It's the most genius advertising. It's like, you're probably not going to be good enough for this job. And everyone that actually, you know, is the right personality would be like, oh, really? Hold my beer. So exactly, it was genius. All right. Well, then Afghanistan the first time. Rather than drag you through all the details of every single one, I'm going to put this to you and you can draw from Afghanistan and Iraq, and we'll kind of go to each one, you know, in a minute. But overall perspective, certainly here in America, probably less so in the UK, but we get a very polarized view of war. You know, maybe it's worse now back home. Either a very pro-war rhetoric, you know, kill them all, let God sort them out, or a very anti-war rhetoric, you know, they're all baby killers. And in the middle are the men and women that actually stand, you know, boots on the ground with our flag on their shoulder, you know, doing what we asked them to do. So two-part question. The first part, regardless of the politics that sent you there, was there a point, it could be first Afghan, you know, whenever it was, where you realized that there were some, you know, horrific people committing atrocities that you and your men in this case were going to address?
Yeah, you're 100% right. And social media doesn't help with any of this stuff now, because you get so many people that are opinionated off the back of the rumor mill. But the realities of it was, if you're going to rape and kill innocent women and children and behead innocent men, then, well, we can't have that. We're going to have to come and put a stop to that. But I feel it's very narrow-minded for people to just give it the baby killer thing and all. Like, we didn't run around murdering people. We were there to stop people getting murdered, because terrorism is a cancer that spreads like wildfire. And that ideology is not a good thing. We've seen it from the Taliban to Al-Qaeda to ISIS to Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab. Whatever continent or country a terrorist organization is in, the atrocities they commit are barbaric. You can't have that.
Absolutely. Well, conversely, other side of the question, the thing that the media does very poorly as well is tar an entire country with the same brush. So, you know, we're at war with Iraq, we're at war with Afghanistan, when we're not. You guys are there helping the native people protect their own communities against these extremists. So we never hear about the kindness and compassion, whether it's from the men and women and children in these countries or whether it's our soldiers or Royal Marines. So when you look back at all of the deployments, you know, were there times where you remember kindness and compassion amidst this battleground?
Yeah, probably the one that sticks out in my head the most is I was deployed into the Middle East as part of a Special Forces Combat Liaison team. And we was in the vehicles, fully laden, big guns. And as we was rolling through this city, you had a lot of the farmers, their children, and all these displaced people that were on the outskirts of the city, all sort of like waving at us like, oh, way, thumbs up and clapping. And obviously they was coming away from the enemy and we was driving towards them. And it was like that sense of pride, yeah, I'll go and get your city back, or certainly try. And that was quite a nice thing to see.
Well, and this is what we don't hear, you know, and I mean, obviously, and I'll get to this in a second, but, you know, there's also that element of, I heard this a lot from, I think it was Iraq and Afghanistan, when we, the allies first, or you, should I say, it wasn't me, when you first got there, you know, early on, there was the same kind of welcome. Oh, these people are going to help liberate our country. The problem is, you fast forward 10 years, we haven't left, you know, and now there's that turning where people that were our allies now become our enemies.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think it didn't help with the withdrawal of Afghanistan either, because we put a lot of time, effort, money, building relationships and infrastructure into that country and then pretty much just run away overnight. Probably destabilized the country within a week. But obviously I don't make them decisions. But there was definitely a lot of good that come out of it. I did a 7-month tour in Afghanistan where I was embedded with their special forces, and I spent a lot of time with Afghan people in a small team. We'd eat together, sleep together, go out on the ground together and try and rid these towns, cities and villages of, you can't even really call them humans, they're monsters. If you go into a village and go, are you joining us? And they say no, and then you start beheading everyone in the middle of the street, you're a monster. And there's only one thing for you, because once you've got that mindset of that's that violent and that horrific, you can never change that. I know people say, oh, I see the good in people. You're never changing that. Once you are that far gone that way and you're that extreme, there's no coming back from that. Which is why the military has to intervene to try and bring peace and stability to the region. As you said, the media are very good at painting the wrong picture.
You have quite an interesting perspective, because you know, were in Afghanistan certain times during, you know, the last decade or so. Rather than, again, pull individual events out of each deployment, what did you see as far as the progression? You know, was it an evolution? Was it a devolution? You know, with each time that you visited, you know, how did your perspective change? And then also, I guess I'll throw in there the success or the challenges of some of the tactics that we're employing amongst the allies.
So my first Afghan, there was IED strikes, but they wasn't really heard of by that point. Certainly not towards the back end of the campaign, where it was every day someone was treading on an IED, which gave us the freedom of movement to push out further. So, for example, I was in a place called Kajaki in northern Helmand province. When we was out there in 2007 and 8, our northern forward line of enemy troops was about 5 kilometers, and to the south it was about 7. And then when I went back in 2010, I went to the Sangin district center, which was, as everyone knows, one of the Taliban's main strongholds. And some of my friends that went back to Kajaki were saying that the forward line of enemy troops had now come into sort of like within a couple of kilometers and on the northern side to 500 meters. So we'd lost a lot of ground. And I think it's probably to do with some of the stipulations that were placed on us that kind of give the enemy the upper hand. So I think it was always a case of cat and mouse, really. We'd take ground, we'd lose it. We'd take ground, we'd lose it. And then when I went back to Afghanistan in 2011 to 12, I was part of a different unit where it was all strike stuff, all int-based or intelligence-based. So we spent the whole tour finding out where Taliban strongholds were, IED factories, and all the stuff that was causing the men and women in the FOBs and patrol bases a hard time. We were going out and hitting them at night. And that was very rewarding because of the stuff that we was taking off target. We was denying weapons, drugs, homemade explosives, denying IED factories. And that was all having a direct effect on the whole bigger battle picture.
Speaking of drugs, I've said this a few times on the show. When I first started the podcast, you know, the opium in Afghanistan specifically would come up, and the soldiers, you know, airmen, whoever it was, were talking, were very tight-lipped. And it wasn't like I was pushing. It was just like, oh, okay, that's definitely a no-go area. And then 3-4 years ago, all of a sudden the door flew open and everyone was talking about it. And I think it's an important perspective in this world where we've demonized addiction. And it's such an irony because so many people in uniform struggle. A lot of our men and women are, you know, leaning into something, alcohol, opiates, you know, whatever it is. And now plant medicine, you know, ayahuasca, you know, MDMA, all these things that we demonize are actually healing a lot of our warfighters from the trauma that they experienced. But with this prohibition, with this demonization of addiction, and we're, you know, we're throwing people who have a mental health condition in prison, thinking that will magically stop them being addicted. You know, we've created so many issues, and we see it in America. Like, as a firefighter and a paramedic here, I saw the gangs, I saw the homelessness, I saw the sex workers, I saw all the things, the overdoses, and that's all from drug prohibition. Talk to me about what you observed and how the illicit drug trade was funding the terrorism that you guys were fighting.
Well, I'll give you one example. We stopped a vehicle and, well thought out, they'd obviously built and welded in secret compartments within a white Toyota Corolla. And when we stripped it, it had £11 million worth of processed heroin in it. £11 million UK pounds worth. That's buying you a lot of weapons, a lot of ammunition, a lot of explosives to continue on with your war effort. And that was just one car on one night. So you think of how many you'd have: the American Special Forces, British Special Forces, the Australians, Canadians, Estonians, all people doing strike ops. You'd have the men and the women in the PBs going out on patrols, seizing drugs and stumbling across factories and opiate fields and all that stuff. But £11 million on one day probably wasn't going to make a great difference when the country had so much of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you know where a lot of that was destined? Was it Europe or the US?
I don't know. No. Yeah. I'd imagine, I mean, probably everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I know the US consumes 75% of the world's opioids. So I'm sure a lot of it was coming here.
Yeah.
What about Iraq for a moment? The contrast between Afghanistan and Iraq, because again, you know, dragnetting, we're at war with both. Everyone, again, I said, say everyone, there is you know, a lack of education that makes people think that those two are very similar countries. But, you know, having guests and people that from those places, obviously you've got, you know, mountainous Afghanistan, very, very tribal. Then you have Iraq that used to be, you know, a playground for a lot of people from Europe. What was the difference that you saw through your eyes from the countries themselves and, you know, wearing uniform as far as the military side?
So I didn't do any war fighting in Iraq. I was there to help train their Navy to patrol their waterways. But it was just very westernized. I remember being in southern Iraq and kind of thinking this resembles like a Turkey or an Egypt or something like that. Whereas, as you just alluded to, Afghanistan was fields, green zone, and very, very mountainous. So they were two totally different landscapes. And Iraq, yeah, I wasn't there for the invasion. I was too young and I wasn't even in the military then. So the lads who did all the war fighting, I definitely did none of that there. I was more sort of like on a training role, if you like, to help their Iraqi Marines and Navy patrol their waterways.
What was your specialty in the Royal Marines? Was it anti-tank?
Yeah, so I was anti-tanks.
So I heard you know, getting assigned and deploying to Afghanistan. Forgive my naivety, but when I think of that conflict, I don't think of tanks. So, you know, what would be the target? Were there a lot of, you know, tanks amongst the Taliban, or was it more that you were aiming towards heavy guns or some of the other areas that you could use the same weapon systems for?
Yeah. So there wasn't a lot of tanks, but the anti-tank missiles and the anti-tank weapon systems that we had had good range on them, which meant we could provide fire support for the Marines that were going door to door, going into the compounds. We could get on the high ground and we could help either dig them out of trouble or fire them into a village or a town, for example. And the Javelin anti-tank missile, it's got two settings. So it's got a top attack for hitting the turret of a tank, but you can also switch it to direct attack, which was proving quite useful to use against built up far positions that the Taliban had.
What about the evolution of the IED? I've had some people on here who, are EOD and talking about, again, you said they were cat and mouse, like they would figure out how to, you know, defuse a certain one, and then, you know, the Taliban would create a different version, or they'd create a second device, so they lure them with the first.
Yeah.
What were you seeing as far as the evolution of that and then the impact on the men that you served with?
So the first IED exposure I ever come across was when, unfortunately, three of our lads in my section detonated the device. But this was early on in the Afghan campaign, so it was 82 millimeter mortars hooked up to a pressure plate with a battery source, and that was how that was detonated, victim operated. And then fast forward 2012, I was part of a team that I was leading that closed down an IED factory, and we found like glass test tubes with three different substances in it, and it'd have like a gray powder with a purple liquid in between, and then a white powder. Obviously, I'm not EOD, so I'm not even going to pretend like I know what it was, but it looked like something that needed to get pushed up the chain through the correct channels, and it was so far advanced that it took out needing a battery pack, which obviously brings it to no metal content. So when people were using mine clearance drills with metal detectors, they'd do all sorts of things, run longer wires. They had no metal content IEDs, even solar paneled IEDs, where they'd dig them in at night. And then when you come along, obviously they've been watching us as we watch them. The Valor Man, as we call them, who would be the point man scanning for devices in the ground, he'd come along with his paintbrush or his fingers to sweep to confirm whether it was just a Coke can or a improvised explosive device, and then the sunlight had hit the solar panel and bang. They got very good with it. They started daisy chaining them. So if someone hit one, you'd have four or five go off together. Or another country I went to later in my career, well, which was actually my last job, they had even figured out how to put them on PIR. So, you know, like in your house where you've got an alarm and you've got the motion detector in the corner for if anyone breaks through your back door, they'd managed to set them so it would take out the fifth person in the stack, for example. So yeah, they got very good with IEDs, and they got very complex.
So what about yourself? I mean, we've been hearing obviously some, you know, some lower up tempo deployments and then some very high ones, you know, high fatality rate. I heard you again on the podcast saying that this was the first time since Korea that you lost so many Royal Marines. Talk to me about the impact of, you know, on you. I mean, you've got, you know, this high stress level, sleep deprivation, you know, all these other things, and then loss after loss after loss. Did you have any lows in your own mental health as you were progressing through?
I wouldn't say mental health. I definitely got quite bitter and wanted a hell of a lot of revenge. I was in a couple of situations where I watched my friends unfortunately get blown up and die, and then obviously they'd use an IED strikers to come on, then you get ambushed, so you've got to try and sort your casualties out but at the same time repel an ambush. So there was definitely some horrific days out there, but like we was talking at the beginning of this about what made that generation through World War II so good, is the tough times brought everyone together and just made us more concrete together, and everyone, yeah, what we had was special. Like everyone was in the same boat and we was all in it together, and we was going to move mountains to make sure that we'd all be all right whilst completing our mission.
I want to get to your transition in a second, but as you're going through this, I'm assuming that some of your men are transitioning out. What did you see as far as the impact once they left? And the reason why I say this, I had Sebastian Junger on several times, and he wrote Tribe, and you know, his observation as an embedded journalist was, again, I think they were in Restrepo. So it was one of the highest impacted places in Afghanistan. And he saw, like you said, I mean, they lost people. Restrepo was named after one of their guys. But he saw this just, you know, iron forge of these men. But when they went back to Italy to demob, was when he started seeing it all kind of coming apart because they weren't around each other anymore. And they all started going home. What were you seeing as far as some of your fellow Marines when they transitioned out and now they didn't have that tight-knit group anymore and they weren't wearing the uniform and they lost their kind of purpose for a bit that so many of us do when we transition out?
I think looking back, there's certain things I think the Royal Marines did wrong as an organization, which cost people their mental health. And I'll elaborate because I'll probably get slated for slating the Royal Marines. But we'd come back from Afghanistan as a tight-knit unit that's just spent 7 months war fighting. And if you didn't have a specialization, like myself, I was anti-tank, so I'd stay within my troop, within my company. Some of the younger lads, and I don't necessarily mean age-wise, I mean like maybe a year or two out of training that they hadn't specialized yet, they were getting sent off on courses or to other drafts. Like sometimes one incident, one of the lads from our troop, he got sent to a naval establishment. And I think things like that were quite harsh because he's just gone through all that trauma for 7 months with a band of brothers and you've just drafted him to a naval base where he's not going to be around like-minded people or people that have shared the same heartache and sort of like team cohesion that we had. And I think people just go inside themselves and are like, oh, I'm not part of that anymore. Same as when people leave service. 1 minute you're a team leader or something on operations and it's you're the most important thing for the United Kingdom's military at that time. And then a month later, you're outside. And it's like, oh, where do I belong now? That's all I can guess because, touch wood, luckily, I don't feel that I struggle with any mental health.
It's an important conversation, though, and it should be there to make the Royal Marines better. It shouldn't, you know, that's the problem is that we shy away from some of these conversations, but it's not an empty criticism. It's constructive criticism. Hey, you know, we did it one way and it seemed to cause problems. I don't know if you have an issue with suicide like we do in fire and police here, but I mean, you know, the behind the scenes of this heroic profession that we do is a lot of men and women struggling, a lot of suicides, a lot of overdoses, a lot of alcoholism. And it's not all doom and gloom, but the only way we're going to fix it is to change the way that we do it. Otherwise, we'll just keep doing the same thing.
Of course. Yeah, fully agree. Unfortunately, I have lost a few friends that have taken their own lives because the demons got the better of them. But at the same time, times are changing and more help's becoming available. And I think we're still well behind, but we're moving in the right direction.
About a year and a half ago, I got to visit Reorg in Plymouth and I had Sam Sheriff kind of ran a jiu-jitsu class and rolled with, oh my goodness, I'm blanking on his name now. Junior, rolled with Junior and got murdered by both of them. But, you know, I saw how, you know, them and then obviously Ben, whose gym it was, had created this place for Royal Marines to reconvene, to be together again. And I just sat there having coffee, you know, before and after. And there was some, you know, some pretty mature Royal Marines coming in. And it was incredible. So that's what's needed, you know, is to prepare us for transition in the first place. If you've had someone literally, you know, in combat, don't dump them out 2 days later. Now they're in Sainsbury's wondering what the fuck just happened. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then also give them a place to feel connected, whether it's a firefighter and you bring them back in for training or, you know, whatever it is, you've given everything to that tribe that has become your identity. And sometimes it's too far towards the identity, but you can't just, you know, let the doors close behind a man or a woman. And then that's it. You cut the strings. I mean, they've given you so much. So we owe it to them to make that transition smoother and then give them a place where they can be amongst their men and women again.
Yeah, 100% agreed.
Well, you mentioned somewhere in the Middle East. So let's transition to there. I know February 2019 was a pretty poignant day for you, or, you know, month for you, should I say.
Yeah, great job. Best job I ever did. At the pinnacle of my soldiering career, doing covert operations against ISIS. And it was relentless every day. There was we were scrapping every day. Obviously, we were trying to rid the Middle East of ISIS, because everyone knows who ISIS are. They were on the world stage for the atrocities they were committing. And I'd engaged a Daesh position. And about 10 minutes later, we got engaged with an American anti-tank missile, not by the Americans, but it had got into the wrong hands after being gifted to the Iraqi army. And then we got hit with a TOW anti-tank missile, suffered some friendly casualties, which thankfully they're still all right and still with us today. Unfortunately, we did lose three of our indigenous forces that we were partnered with. And then four of us got sent home the following day. We got medevaced because a few of us were slurring and not too steady on our feet. Come back to Birmingham Hospital, had MRI scans, hearing tests, all the general checkup and lookovers. And then I actually flew back into the Middle East for another month and continued on as if nothing had ever happened. I come home on my R&R, so I had 2 weeks at home. And the day before I was due to fly back to do the second half of my tour, I had a phone call from a very high-ranking lady at Birmingham Hospital who kind of become like a mother figure to me throughout the next part of this story, telling me that I had to be at hospital at 8 o'clock the following morning. At the time, I was in Guildford, so it's a good 2.5-3 hour drive. And she said, "Don't drive." And I went, "Well, I'm going to Heathrow tomorrow because I'm going back in the theatre." She was like, "You're not. You'll be here at 8 o'clock in the morning." And I was like, maybe this might be serious. So my mum drove me to Birmingham Hospital. I was rushed in for a MRI scan. And then it was kind of like being a celebrity. There was loads of people in white overcoats and clipboards. And, "Oh, yeah, come with me, Mr. Eilert." And then we walked into a doctor's office. There was like a hollow square of chairs sat around, again, all people in suits and clipboards. And I remember saying out loud, "Well, this doesn't look fucking good, does it?" And they sat me down and said, they tried all the pink and fluffy, softly approach. "Oh, God, I can't suffer it." I said, "Can we just get to the point? Because clearly there's something going on. I'd rather just know than beat around the bush." And then they started to explain to me what brain tumours were. And I was like, I don't really know anything about them, to be honest. Obviously, I know they exist, but I'd never known anyone with one. I'd never really heard anything about the severity of what a brain tumour can do to a person's life. And that was the start of the end of my career, really. And they thought the end of my life, but tomorrow I'll make it into the top 6% of survivors in the world.
Talk to me about that, though. I mean, you've literally escaped death, you know, in combat zones for years and years and years. Now you sit there surrounded by super attentive medical personnel. You know, what was that news and then the first couple of days for you like? Because, I mean, that's a pretty terrifying diagnosis to be given.
Well, I remember sitting in the office and all I kept doing was looking at my watch thinking, if they hurry up with this, I can still make that flight out of Heathrow.
Got nothing to lose now.
And I was just like, do you know what? I didn't even really care. I just knew that my pals were on the ground mixing it up and I wanted to be there. And they obviously told me what brain tumours were. And at this precise moment in time, they couldn't determine the severity of what brain tumour I had. But all they told me is it had to come out with an emergency craniotomy. So I said, "Well, I've only got 3 months of the tour left. So if I do the 3 months, then I've got a month's leave. Can we worry about this on my month's leave and then we'll crack on as normal?" And they kind of looked at me as if I was, I think they were a bit gobsmacked. I don't know whether they was looking at me as if I was stupid or not. But they were like, no, I don't think you're grasping the severity of this. I was like, yeah, but surely we can worry about it in 3 months' time. Can't be that bad. And they were like, you are not deploying back into theatre. That's that. Done. So I was like, oh, brilliant. And the best thing was, is I got the drive home past Heathrow thinking, oh, there's my flight. And then 3 weeks later, I had the craniotomy, because they had to give me loads of steroids to reduce the swelling in my brain to be able to do surgery. So I went in and I had pretty much a large percentage of the front right part of my brain removed. And then they obviously sent it off for a biopsy. I was in hospital for a bit. The lads were coming to visit me every day, which was nice. And then it was about 10 days later, I had a meeting with my consultant. So I was actually with a friend of mine, because my mum and dad had taken my children on holiday and they were going to cancel the holiday. And I said, no, that's not fair on my kids, because none of us planned for me to be here. So I'd like you to still, they've been looking forward to the holiday. I'd like you to still go on a family holiday and I'll be all right. So my friend come and stayed with me in the hospital, because the whole time I'm staying in an amazing facility called Fisher House, which is a welfare house for the families of injured soldiers. And at the time, obviously, the country wasn't really engaged in a known war. Afghanistan, the combat operations had died right down. So the house was pretty much empty, and they was using it for service members with cancer that needed a place to stay, that had traveled far from for treatment or any follow-up appointments. So I got to stay in there for a lot longer than I anticipated, but it was a lovely facility with amazing people. So me and my friend walked over to the main hospital, which is like a 5-minute walk. And he said to me, how are you feeling? I went, well, there's only two outcomes. I'm either good or fucked. That's it. There's no in between, is there? It's one or the other. And he went, nah, you'll be all right. You're good. I went, well, we'll find out in 10 minutes. And went in, same scenario. People sat around. And I looked around and I was like, come on, hit me with it. And they basically said, you've got 12 to 15 months to live. We need to start chemo and radiotherapy immediately. So I was like, okay. And I looked at my mate and he's like got tears rolling down his cheek. And I was like, so he told you I'd either be fucked or good, I'm fucked. And tried making a bit of a joke about him. I don't think anyone saw the funny side apart from myself. And then it was a very quiet walk back to Fisher House. And then the worst part of it all was phoning and telling other people. I can deal with it on my own. It's when you hear other people's, when their voice goes and you're like, oh, I've just ruined someone's day. And then I was put into a 9-month prolonging life phase where I had 2 chemotherapies, maximum radiotherapy, but one of the chemotherapies was making me go blind. So I pulled myself off of that one and just said, look, I'd rather die than be blind, because I can't see anything. That ain't happening. So I just cracked on, and then I kind of got a bit fed up with sitting around, really. So the welfare officer told me that I had 2 years sick leave to die peacefully at home. And I was like, now I'm going back to work. So I went back to work, and the second lot of chemo that I had it for about 6 or 7 months. It was tablet form. It was the intravenous one that was making me go blind. So I said, well, look, I can take my chemo whilst at work. And if I feel ropey, I'll just go to the toilet, throw up and crack on. So I started helping running courses and heavy weapons carders back in the unit and supporting the pre-deployment training, ready for other units and other teams to go out the door. And then that's where I started doing the counterterrorism liaison officer stuff with the police, the CTSFOs. So, yeah, that was quite a hectic time. And then COVID hit. So then it was like, go home. I was like, I'd rather be here. But I was trying to, like, just show people that this ain't going to beat me. Get me back on the ground. But there was no doctor that was ever going to sign off a bloke who's terminally ill and got not long to live to go running around the Middle East again.
Talk to me about the recovery, because as you said, you know, this was 2019. You were given just over a year to live, and we're sitting here in 2024 now. What did they see? And then you kind of alluded to it a little bit. Talk to me about your mindset, because you did the same kind of treatments that I'm sure lots of other people with the same, you know, brain tumor had, but not allowing yourself to think about, I'm just going to go home and die. Because you think about, even retire, take cancer out completely. People who retire from this profession, if they don't have purpose, a lot of our, you know, men and women do pass away in their 50s, even though they should have been alive arguably for another 30, 40 years. Yeah. So talk to me about the mindset that you had from diagnosis through to when we're sitting here today.
I think it was, I looked back at my career and I've been in, I couldn't even tell you how many firefights I've been in. Obviously I've been involved in two explosions, and I was just like, I've had probably four or five situations where I've sat there, thought of my kids and my family and gone, this is it. And then you get that, I love it. I think it's the best thing in the world. The best feeling is when you're backed so far into a corner and you want to curl up into a ball, but you find that hunger within yourself and go, no. Everyone's getting put in the ground before we are. And then you just find that fight and that willing. And I thought, oh, I've survived too much to go through a disease and just die in a hospital bed. I was like, I ain't having that. So I was like, you say terminal, I say temporary.
I like that. Should be a t-shirt.
Just cracked on, really. I think going back to work helped, because I was still active. But during my treatment, because I'd still be in the hospital for quite a lot of it, I used to turn up sort of like the unit I was part of. We used to get issued civilian clothing. So like your North Face, your Rab, your Foul Raven, your Arc'teryx, we used to get issued that for certain parts of the rotation. So I used to make a point of wearing that for my treatment. And then when I wasn't having treatment and I wore my Armani jeans and my Stone Island cardigans and my Ralph Lauren polo tops, there was a difference. So I kind of treated my treatment as work, something that needs to be done. And then my civvy life, going to football and out with my friends, I'd wear different clothes. So I wouldn't be sat there looking at a pair of trainers going, oh, I had chemo in them 3 days ago. So I kind of like just compartmentalized, this is what I need to do and this is how I'm going to do it. Went back to work, did all of that, and I just carried on training. I wasn't breaking any records, like going to the gym, because obviously I was ropey and I did throw up a few times. I lost all my hair and everything like that. But in my head, if I did 15 minutes on a treadmill or half an hour on a bike or a rower, that was, in my head, a victory of more than what anyone else in my situation was doing. And I just kind of stuck with that, really. And I kind of looked at everything as like, that. Well, that's a positive step forward. Because going back wasn't an option. It was, you can go left and you can go right, but you can't go backwards. You've got to find a way of going forwards. And I just chose different ways of finding ways to go forward, which must be working. Because as I said earlier, tomorrow I'll make it into the top 6% of survivors in the world with what I've got. And then once tomorrow's out of the way, we'll ignore that and we'll focus to the 10-year and get into the 1%.
It's interesting how you said that you chose to stop chemo. And obviously, I mean, losing your vision is a pretty strong, you know, motivator for that. But I think it's very exciting. We're starting to shift seemingly into the world of immunotherapy now, which I'm not super well versed in, but it seems a lot safer for the patient, a lot more targeted for the cancer. Because when you look back and you look at, you know, I mean, the women that have breast cancer and the children that have leukemia, and, you know, these chemo treatments destroy them. I mean, they absolutely, you know, and there's no way of knowing, but I can't help but feel that chemo kills some of these people more than cancer does. You know, maybe that if they'd been able to do some, as you said, some mindset shifts, some exercise, some change in diet, who knows, maybe they could have, you know, reversed whatever they were going through. But you took away one of your treatments and you actually had great success. So, you know, what is your observation of just that, of being your own advocate, even if you're going through a terminal diagnosis and receiving chemo at the time?
I think if I look back at all the time I spent in that prolonging life phase in the cancer center, I'd say the majority of it is all in the mind. Because I'd see people in the cancer center, as you do with either their partner or parents, and you'd see them go into the oncologist's offices, and then you'd see them come out and you'd see certain people just drop their heads. And I was like, ah, you've just given up on life. Like you've literally just been told something by another human and you've come out and gone. And I think that is where it goes wrong, when people drop their heads and go, oh, I'm going to die. That's the end of it. Like, you need to value your life and fight for your life until you're in a box, because until you're in a box, who knows how long you got. The chemo that I stopped having was a trial. It was part of a trial. So I still had another load of chemo and radiotherapy anyway. But I was kind of at the point of, this is just horrific, and I'm not going to spend my last days, however long I have, being blind. So that was just an option. I'd kind of already accepted that I'd rather die than be blind. So that wasn't really a hard decision for me to make.
What about diet? You talked about, you know, working out, and again, not having to break records, but just keep moving again, you know, get the blood pumping, working on strengthening your body, getting outside. Did you change the way you were eating at all?
Nah, my diet was terrible. My diet was horrific. The thing is I can only imagine this is the closest I'll ever get to feeling what a pregnant woman has. And I had some really out there cravings. So all I wanted was a chicken royale with cheese from Burger King, a fillet of fish from McDonald's, Aunt Bessie's toad in the holes, and Nando's. That was it. That's all I ever wanted. And that's pretty much all I ate for months on end, just because the chemo was giving me them weird cravings as that's what I wanted. And because I thought I was going to die anyway, I was like, oh, I certainly ain't going to start eating broccoli and Brussels sprouts and carrots and that. You know what I mean? Because if I've only got a year, I want to eat and enjoy what I like.
Yeah, but well, one of those four is good food at least. Nando's, the rest is shit.
Oh, yeah, totally shit. Hey, I'm still here, though, 5 years later. Maybe McDonald's will give you a little marketing number.
Don't tell him that. You'll be the next Jared from Subway. That didn't end well. All right. Well, then you mentioned about COVID hitting. So talk to me about sitting down and writing your book, Every Day is a Battle, Fighting Demons, Jihadis, and Terminal Cancer.
So obviously I went back to work. I was doing what I was doing at work, loving life, just trying every day. Every day to me was a victory because I hadn't died yet. And then COVID hit, but I just bought a house to be closer to my children, to spend as much time as I could, as close to them as I could, in case obviously I did pass away. And I got the keys to my house the day that the UK went into its first proper lockdown. So where my friends who were in the trades industries couldn't work, a lot of them helped me do my house up, so it was livable. So I had my own house, which yet again was another positive, because I'd just been told I'm going to die anytime soon. And a few of my mates from within the special forces group at various different units were like, mate, if you're just sat at home, you need to write a book. I was like, I don't know. Don't know nothing about writing a book. And then what birthday would it have been? So it must have been my 31st birthday, I think. My nan bought me an Apple Mac computer, like laptop. And I started having a little play around to see if I could string sentences and paragraphs together in a way that people might actually think I knew what I was going on about. And it started like that. And then by the end of it, I was able to type all right. So it took me about between 12 and 14 months. And I had a 76,000 word manuscript. Sent it off to the Special Forces Disclosure Cell, because of obviously spending 6 years in the group. They went through it, and I had to redact or retract 33% which shocked me a little bit, because I thought I'd been very careful with what I'd spoke about. As long as I didn't say countries, tactics and people and all that stuff, I thought I was all right. But there was stuff that was explained to me that just couldn't go in there. So it was like changing plays on words. So, the head of the disclosure cell come around my house and actually sat with me and helped me salvage my manuscript. And then they give me the green light to publish. So then I sent it to an editor who went through it. And then because of COVID, no publishers were taking on new manuscripts. So I just self-published on Amazon and just got it out there. So there's actually one here.
Beautiful. I self-published on Amazon too. What was your experience of that? I don't know if you had the same thing, but when I asked a lot of people, and I did ask, all kinds of people, what I got back was, if you and I were Stephen King, a publisher would absolutely make sense, because they would do everything they could to promote it and put it in bookstores and all those kind of things. But if you are Rianne or James, who no one knows, they might give you a small advance and you have their logo on your book, but they're not going to really put any effort into promoting. And you might have a big bill for, creating the book that now you got to sell, X amount of thousand before you even make a penny. So yeah. To me, you don't have the kind of marketing ability that a publisher would have when you self-publish. But the beautiful thing is, you can put out your book and you hit upload and it's like, all right, there it goes. So, I've asked you a question and gave you a fucking monologue after that. So what was your kind of experience with that type of publishing?
Well, I was getting nowhere with any publisher. I think I sent out about 10 emails asking if they were accepting manuscripts. And because of the pandemic, no one was doing anything. So all I wanted to achieve with my book, there was nothing in it to do with financial gain or anything. It was, if one person read my book and went, oh, fuck me, I'm going to crack on as well, I'd achieve my aim. And yeah, I've had quite a few messages of people coming to me saying that they've read my book and look at life in a different perspective now. So as far as I'm concerned, I achieved my aim with starting all that. Even only a month ago, I had someone message me, so I saved their life, which was overwhelming to receive a message like that off the back of a book. But as far as the publishing went, I found it very easy. And because I wasn't in it for the financial gain, I just kind of forgot about it. It's on Amazon. Obviously, I tell people if they buy it, they buy it. You know what I mean? It's just, I haven't got to think about it. It's just there. And it's left a legacy. So when I do die in about 50 years' time, because I'm going nowhere anytime soon, there'll be a book left behind. So at least I've left something behind.
Absolutely. Well, this is, when you hear... There's that term, the quiet professional, the silent professional, and a lot of, the SF and special operations, men and women didn't talk about it. But I think, as you mentioned, if you just leave out the specificities, we were here doing this, with these people, and just tell the human stories, there's so much power to it. And when, a Royal Marine talks about not only, their early life and then finding themselves in Mexico for a year and entering the Royal Marines in Afghanistan and Iraq and then a brain cancer diagnosis, there's so much value to that. And, the other 33%, who cares? And I use that phrase all the time. If it helps one single person, it sounds like you've done so much more than that. Yeah. Anyone writing a book to make money is a fool. Yeah. So therefore, write a book that you're actually makes a difference money. In the world.
You are not making money out of it.
All right. Well, then just while we're on the cancer conversation, before I go to some closing questions, there is a great organization in America called the Hunter 7 Foundation, and they really highlight cancer in uniform, in the military specifically here in the US, and the burn pits and, the contaminated water and some of the things that have killed a lot of our, war fighters here. What is that conversation in the UK? Are you seeing a lot of cancer in our, especially our Iraq and Afghan era soldiers and sailors and Royal Marines? And if so, are there organizations that are taking care of them?
I think we're very far behind when it comes to stuff like that, because I actually follow Hunter 7 and have for a couple of years now. I don't know how but that I come across them on Instagram, and they had actually shared my book, which I thought was mental, because I have, but obviously I have worked with Americans a lot in my career, especially the later stages of my career. So I don't know how it got to Hunter 7, but they published my, not published, but promoted my book for me. And I was like, oh, who are these? And then I interact with them regularly just off of the back of the studies that they've got going on that they publish on their platform. But yeah, the UK is just so far behind.
Are you seeing a lot of cancer then in the military there?
I don't know, to be honest. Not that I'm aware of. I know a lot of people in the military, and I wouldn't say, having followed Hunter 7 for a few years now, it's certainly not, in my opinion, anywhere near like that. But then we're a much smaller armed forces.
Yeah.
We're only sat at about 60, 70,000 as a whole military. So I think that's probably got a part to play in it. But I'm actually in court in May, because when I left service, my pension and the payout I received was pretty pathetic. And there's now possibly they think maybe now they know I had a brain tumor, because it was missed years before when I was part of a PTSD study to try and help soldiers with PTSD, and it was benign. But then within 2 years, it went to the most aggressive form of cancer you can get, which is a glioblastoma. So I said, well, surely in that 2 year period where I'm firing every weapons, rockets, been hit with a missile, something has had to have activated that benign tumor into a malignant cancer. Obviously, the military are disagreeing at the moment, but I take a lot from Hunter 7 and the people that they've published their articles back into my case. But yeah, hopefully the UK, there's obviously people working in the background that I'm not privy to, but we're nowhere near that Hunter 7 level where they are actively going out of their way to help veterans with cancer.
It's the same even in the fire service. We have what's called cancer presumption laws. And what's supposed to happen is, if you get these listed cancers that are supposed to be related to the fire service, then you get coverage. And obviously your family gets coverage if you pass away. But I've heard from so many people that the insurance companies behind these, you know, coverages will fight these first responders, knowing that if they die before there's a, you know, an agreement, then they don't have to pay them. So there's some really nasty underhanded stuff. And also, take the fires out, the way that we work in the first responder professions, like here in America, the average work week is 56 hours a week, not sleeping every third day for 10, 20, 30 years. That in itself is a carcinogen. So they're wanting you to prove, oh, which fire were you in that gave you this? And it's like, well, it's not that. That's a little piece of it. You're asking someone to be awake every third day, you know, or 12 hours, you know, three night shifts a week or whatever it is, a shift worker, that's classified as a carcinogen in itself, you know? So if we're going to ask these men and women to fight for our country, or, you know, hold the line while you sleep softly in your bed, then we've got to take care of our military and our first responders, you know, for doing that.
Yeah. Well, they got this thing I saw on the Hunter 7 page a few weeks ago, operator syndrome, which brings exactly what you've just spoke about into play, alongside with the firing of heavy machine guns, rockets, and all the stuff that goes with it, the blast waves and mild traumatic brain injuries and all of that stuff. So I've sent all that to my representation, and we'll see what happens in May. No doubt I'll just get shit on, but you got to try.
Yeah.
Never exactly. Open until it's over.
No. May as well fight. Exactly. All right. Well, I want to go to some closing questions so I can be mindful of your time. The first one I love to ask, we talked about your book, and just to give the title one more time, Every Day is a Battle, Fighting Demons, Jihadis, and Terminal Cancer. Are there any other books written by other people that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
I'll be deadly honest. I've never read a book. I've never read a book. Obviously, I had a busy childhood, causing misdemeanors, went to Mexico, come back from Mexico, had to catch up with my education, join the Marines, and then it was kind of like just a operational cycle constantly. I did 7 operational tours, COVID it, I wrote a book. Well, actually, cancer, then COVID, then wrote a book. So it's like I've never really had any time. I've never read a book.
Did you find it hard writing a book when you hadn't read a book? And the reason I say that is as because I've written one, I'm writing my second one now, finishing it up. And I have this imposter syndrome because I'm writing a fiction now. I don't read fiction that much. And so I'm like, how am I going to do this when I don't even read very many? Like, how do you... You know, how do you get a person to talk while you're writing in a book? You know, how do you describe, you know, what they're wearing, all this stuff? But if I think back and, you know, I'm assuming you read books and textbooks in school, but after that, reading a book. Yeah. How did that factor into your writing? Did you struggle to write?
I really enjoyed it because I wrote it in a way of me talking. And it was good because so much had gone on in my career. I was phoning people I hadn't spoke to in 10 years, going, oh, mate, do you remember that day? And it was like just bringing my relationships closer together and reminiscing over old times. And, yeah, I just really enjoyed it. And I found it not easy because it was hard work to sit there for 5 hours a day typing away and thinking, does that sound right, rereading it and that. But I think I just typed as I would talk. Yeah, that's all I can say, really. But yeah, a bit weird. I wrote a book, but I've never actually read one.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. If you're ever going to read one, there's one called Tribe by Sebastian Junger, and it's only, I think, 160 pages or something. Mm. Amazing. And it's so pertinent to, you know, war and that, as you said, that brotherhood that you had and finding yourself on the outside. So when people want to ask this question, people either read or they enjoy television and film. So what about films and documentaries? Any of those that you love?
Band of Brothers is an absolute classic. That's obvious. That should be a given for anyone in the military. And then more recently, I've thoroughly enjoyed The Covenant, 12 Strong, 13 Hours, all of them type of recent films about the SEALs and the War on Terror. Hacksaw Ridge was another good one, obviously from way back in the day. Saving Private Ryan. If we're going down like the war film genre, they're some of my favorites.
I had Shane Taylor on the show who played Doc in the Band of Brothers, and then Captain Dale Dye, who was the one that trained all the guys to be soldiers. And amazing. I mean, you hear the kind of behind the scenes. It's you know, such an incredible production, and I think it's such a great reminder as well of what masculinity is supposed to look like. Yeah. Because when you listen to the real men of Easy Company that at that point was still alive and talking at the beginning of the end of each episode, you can see the raw emotion in their faces. Yeah. And these were some of the most, you know, incredible warriors that ever fought wearing an American uniform. And they're in tears. They're in tears about, you know, the people that they lost, the lives that they had to take. I mean, you can see that resonated. So not only was it so well told as far as what they did in the 40s, I think their voices I think back then it was the 90s when they were doing those recordings. You know, I mean, you're talking 50 plus years, 60 years later that a man is supposed to cry. The man is supposed to be moved by loss and all the devastating things they had to endure. And so this facade of men don't cry, you know, rub some dirt in it, stiff upper lip bullshit. Like, yeah, there's a time and place for that, like in a firefight or going into a fire, but that's not how we're supposed to be all the time. We have to process those traumas.
Yeah, fully agree.
Brilliant. All right. Well, speaking of amazing people, the next question, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
I'll have to think about it, but I definitely think it should be someone from the medical emergency response team. You know, the people that did all the CASAVACs. The Americans had the Pedro, Hacksaw, we had the Mert. Them people that were like the flying surgical theatres. that were doing operations on board a Chinook or a Black Hawk. Like, them people are, yeah, they're proper heroes, them. They yeah. saved a lot of my brothers. But I'd never really got to meet any, because by the time I got flown home from the Middle East, it, yeah, just where we were quite remote, so I didn't see anyone till I got back to Birmingham. But definitely someone from that side of things, because I think a lot of podcast books, films are about like the kinetic side of things. But obviously them people in the surgeries and on the MERTs, they go through a whole different war that's, well, traumatizing daily, just in a mental capacity and physical for the hours that they're putting in. But what I mean is they're seeing their fellow countrymen blown to smithereens and shot to pieces. And yeah, I think that would be a really interesting one.
100%. And then when you say that, I think again of Mark Ormerod, when he's telling a story of lying there, they all thought he was dead in the corner of a helicopter. And all of a sudden they realize he's still breathing. The next people I'm assuming he saw were exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So, yeah, sorry, I don't know anyone to hand, but from that cohort of professionals.
Well, anyone listening, feel free to message me if you have someone. I think that we need to tell the story. So thank you for that. All right. Well, then the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and your book, what do you do to decompress these days?
I'll go to football, try and work when I can. And I like going to the pub, as most of us do.
What about the England squad? Are they looking good for the Euro?
Same old England, isn't it? Go into every competition with high hopes and then just get your heart broken again.
At the end.
we'll see. There's got to be a time. The tide's got to turn at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, there's only so long we can sing Three Lions before we actually win.
It'll come one day. That's what I'm staying alive right. for, to see them win a trophy.
There we go. But we can't win then, otherwise you're going to drop dead. We can't have that. All right, well, then the very last question. Firstly, the book. Where can people find it? Again, I'll read it one more time. Every Day is a Battle, Fighting Demons, Jihadis, and Terminal Cancer.
It's on Amazon.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's on Amazon.
And then your name is Rian, is it Islet? Is that how you pronounce
yeah.
the last?
Yeah.
That's okay,
it, yeah.
So everyone there is Rianilett.
Yeah. And then I've got an Instagram account that's just my personal, that's got the link to my book on it, and it's Twiggy1664.
All right, I got to ask, why Twiggy?
Because when I passed the commando tests to become a Royal Marine, I was actually under the required weight to join the Royal Marines because of how much weight I'd lost in training. Because my last name was Islet, I got nicknamed Twiglet. Remember them, like...
they're delicious.
The Marmite little stick things.
I loved them.
Yeah, so it just went from Twiglet to Twiggy.
Brilliant. Well, Rian, I want to say thank you so much. It's been such an incredible conversation, such a uplifting conversation, because, I mean, you know, aside from all the combat and the other stuff you talked about, you know, to get that kind of diagnosis when you're still so young. And then it's evident, you know, in this conversation that how much mindset played into it, how much that belief and that determination, that same grit that you got on the battlefield, you know, factored into where you are today. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.